This is the Coaches Rising podcast. Welcome back. And today I am delighted to be joined by Tara Springett. Tara is a Buddhist teacher, Qigong teacher, and a therapist who specializes in spiritual crises and Kundalini syndrome. And at the moment, Tara is inundated with people as more and more people go deeper into their spiritual practice. Tara is also the author of several books, including Higher Consciousness Healing, Advanced Manifesting, and the award-winning book, The Stairway to Heaven. And we're going to talk about that book today. We'll talk about 9 stages of consciousness. What are the key motivations at each stage? How can we stabilize a stage through certain meditation practices? And what things move us from one stage to the next? We'll also talk about manifestation and how Tara learned about this through her Buddhist roots and how Buddhism sees manifestation. I think that's really helpful. And we'll talk about spiritual crises as well and what are some of the key things that Tara does with her clients. So, as you'll hear, Tara has such a wealth of experience and knowledge around these topics. I really enjoyed this conversation. So, let's dive right in. Wait. Before we dive in, actually, I want to take a moment to tell you about the Power of Embodied Transformation. This is our live online coach training program, and it's enrolling now. It's our 10th year doing this. And I used to say this program is incredibly relevant for our times, but I don't actually say that anymore. I say it's essential. And there are several reasons for that. Let me tell you, because if we are to meet the uncertainty and the intensity of our times, we cannot do that from our rational minds. They're not equipped for it. We have to access the intelligence of our embodiment, of our deeper embodied life. And if we want to support our clients to make progress, to create lives around the things that are most important to them, again, we have to drop between just talking to our clients. We have to help them access where the ways that they are stuck around the things that matter most are deeply rooted in their bodies. And once that happens, once we help them bring awareness to that, then transformation can take place and we can support them to embody new ways of being that help them live into the things that are most important to them. This is what our clients want from us. And I believe this intelligence, this embodied intelligence, helps us to transmute, to metabolize the intensity of our times and to access our deeper wisdom. And another thing this program will teach you how to do, on top of all that, is that our clients come in and their nervous systems are dysregulated in these times, understandably. But if that's the case, we can't actually have the coaching conversation. So we need to be able to help our clients to shift, to move back into a regulated state. And this program will go into that as well. And that's where the real coaching can happen. So you will be led by a truly world-class faculty in this program, Stacey Haynes. I think one of the world's best teachers of how do you coach somatically. We did a masterclass with Stacey the other week. And if you want to see the potency of this work, there's a coaching demo that we unpack. And in 15 minutes, it goes incredibly deep and potent shift opens up. Stacey will be joined by Amanda Blake, a real thought leader in neuroscience and embodiment and designing practices that stick. I think this is an edge for many clients. How do you actually design transformational practices, embodied practices for your clients? Also, Richard Strozzi-Heckler will join us, one of the true founders of this field, and his capacity to discern his client's embodiment is masterful, and he's going to be teaching about how he does that alongside some other incredible faculty. So if you are inspired to join us, then you can head to coachesrising.com/power of embodied transformation to book your spot. The first class is 12th of March this year with Stacey. And if you sign up by February the 20th, you can get the early bird discount. Enrollment for the program is open till 6th of March. So just head to coachesrising.com/power of embodied transformation to book your spot. All right, now it is time for the podcast. All right, Tara, it's delightful to be with you. I've been looking forward to this conversation actually a lot. So,
thank you.
Yeah. Maybe a good place just to begin is just to say, could you say a few words about who you are and what you do?
Yes. So I am a psychotherapist, and I'm also a Tibetan Buddhist teacher. And I mostly work with people who have a spiritual crisis, or also known as Kundalini awakening, and they have spiritual crisis symptoms like very strong emotions and negative feelings of energy in their body and confusion and these types of things. And that's my main work.
Yeah, I think we'll get onto that hopefully today. We wanted to talk about also, and I can imagine for you, maybe this is a good question before we segue. Are you probably in demand these days? Yeah, because I can imagine more people as they doing practice or having these kinds of experiences.
Yes, in very high demand. I'm flooded with clients, it's true.
Right. And is it, as someone who actually had, a spiritual crisis myself, and it can be quite a scary experience, actually. Do you find that people find it's easier to move through it than they expected?
Well, I hope I give them the good tools and the help that they can move through it very quickly. And I think I can say that most of my clients feel kind of normal again, as much as that is possible, because you are changed by these experiences forever within a number of months, Most of them do. And particularly if they take the meditations that I give them on board and implement them, then they feel better very quickly.
Yeah. Okay. So let's do what I said. We'll come back to this topic, but I'd love to ask you first about a book of yours I read, and I really enjoyed it, Stairway to Heaven. And in that, yeah, exactly, yeah. You write about these stages of consciousness, and I'd love to kind of unpack that a little bit. I think in particular to our audience, around the kind of sharing, responsibility, love, maybe even bliss stages. I mean, they're more rarefied. But could you tell us what these stages of consciousness are, first of all?
Yes. So there are 9 stages of consciousness, and I have discovered them through observation, but also through reading other stages of consciousness, other authors who discovered some stages of consciousness, and I made a completely new model out of them, which brings in what others have discovered, but also what I have observed, and I also merged different other models and merged it with my own understanding. And so we have these 9 stages of consciousness, and the first one is called innocence. Here, the person is in a state of relative happiness. They feel calm. They are also very confident. They're not plagued by the self-doubt that most of us have on the higher stages of consciousness. It seems to be an enviable place. But these people are also lack desire. And through the lack of desire, they don't achieve much. And they are usually in a tightly knit family group or clan or tribe of some sort. And they live a very low-key, a relatively low-key life in relative harmony. But as I said, they have very little desire. But what they do have is addictive problems. So if they're are exposed to drugs or alcohol, then they find it very difficult to say no to that. So because they don't have the defenses, the inner strength to say no and resist these temptations. And if they experience some sort of trauma, or they are for some reason separated from their group and they find themselves alone, then they're basically for the first time ever, their confidence is threatened, and they look around and they see, I don't measure up. Other people have more, they look better. all the stuff that wasn't a problem when you're at the innocent stage, suddenly you become aware of that. And what happens is then a very big rage, people get very angry. So they at the same time feel very shameful. And very rageful about it. We can just imagine a very angry man who says to another, what are you looking at? Because they can't even stand to be looked at because there's so much shame, but also so much aggression. And So what we call personality disorders, narcissism, psychopathy, sociopathy, that's all people in the dominant stage. And they want what they want with violence, by any means. They don't have self-restraint. And obviously, they also get into a lot of troubles through that, maybe even have to go to prison or get some other repercussions like divorce or something like that. And divorce is also a problem for the innocence people because lack of self-restraint leads to promiscuity and then affairs, and then they might lose their partner, and then they kind of fall out of disharmony, and then they have to fend for themselves. But the positive thing about dominance is that people get finally access to their willpower. They say, "I want," and they say it very loudly at the dominance stage. And they want to pursue their goals, but at the dominant stage, they do it in a very unskillful way, you know, basically with violence or with criminal means or something. And then if they experience quite a lot of repercussions of any kind of sort of divorce or prison or other types of punishment, they might move on to the next stage, which we call obedience. And in the obedience stage of consciousness, people try to submit to a higher rule or authority. And we find that, for example, in people who are part of fundamentalist religion. They see the world as a big pyramid. God is at the top, and then the angels, then the priests, then the men, then the women, then the children, and the animal. So they are usually very misogynistic, and also they are immovable in these places. So everybody has their place. This gives a sense of security, but there's no social mobility. If you're born into a lower class family, that's where you stay all your life. You cannot come up in some way. And here people are still very angry. They have repressed the rage from the dominant stage, but they're then projected on some outer enemy in society. We see this all the time, you know. It's the immigrants, it's the Jews, it's the people of different races. So they get scapegoated, and they can be very, very cruel at this stage. Even though they are so-called Christians or part of a religion, they are truly quite cruel. And they're also cruel to themselves. And so they might have, problems with their health or with their mental health, but they don't even know that, because at that stage, mental health is very stigmatized. You can't talk about it. And now, at that stage, maybe people experience a betrayal. Maybe their church leaders have affairs or embezzle money, and so they lose their faith, or they have a personal tragedy, a child dies, then they lose their faith. You know, God, there's no God, otherwise he wouldn't have done that to my child. And then they move on to the next stage, which is the ambition stage. And the ambition stage is the prevalent stage in our Western societies. So this stage is, we have democracy, we have free speech, we have a form of equality. Everybody is allowed to achieve, and people try to achieve a lot. And so therefore, they are also very stressed. So in this stage, it's all about status. I look better, I have more money, I have the higher position in the pecking order of some sort. A little bit similar to the dominant stage, but at the ambition stage, people can keep to the rules. And they also have better principles, for example, democratic understanding of basic equality of people. And but people are very stressed in that stage. They are not happy. And they might get a question of, what's the meaning of this all? I'm working, working, working. Yes, I have the big house. I've got the two cars. And now what? I'm still not happy. And if this crisis deepens, then they might go on to yet another stage, which is the sharing stage of consciousness. And on the sharing stage of consciousness, people very much worship nature. They love everything that's natural. natural food, natural childbirth, nature, just, you know, in the countryside, it all should be wonderful and there shouldn't be so much tarmac. And they also value friendship very much. And the problem at the sharing stage is that people often have a victim mentality. They feel themselves to be scarred, for example, by their upbringing or by any kind of trauma that are experienced or by society that doesn't allow them to thrive. Maybe they have a small, let's say, carpenter business or a small business of some sort, which is economically not viable because you can't compete with big mass production or something. And then they have some sort of grief and feel like a victim in our society. This kind of, at some point, people might feel, I've had enough of this victim identity, you know. They might be in there for a while, and then eventually they say, okay, there must be something better than this. And then they might move on to the responsibility stage. Now, usually during the sharing stage, people have a spiritual awakening or reawakening. At the lower stages, innocence, dominance, obedience, people are usually part of the religion into which they're born into. They don't choose that. But at the sharing stage, people say, oh, I don't want to be a Christian anymore. I go to the East, I become a Buddhist or a Hinduist or something like that, or Taoist. There's all new, exciting, new possibilities. And so then when they go to the responsibility stage, they do away with the victim mentality and they basically take responsibility for every problem that they have in their life. I have a problem, I caused it myself. How do they understand that? Through the law of karma. So they really start believing in the law of karma and believe that whatever happens to them is that they have caused it themselves. And they apply that even to things like a genetic disease, because they also believe in previous lives. And then they say, okay, I got that. I brought that with me from my previous life. So there's nothing basically excluded from this radical self-responsible attitude. The only problem at that stage is that people can be a little bit overconfident. So they usually start working with the law of attraction, that they try to get what they want through visualization techniques. And then they think, I can manifest anything I want very quickly, and I can heal my body, and I can eat even unhealthy food, and it doesn't matter because I can heal myself. And that's all a little bit overconfident, you know. This is while we can bend reality to our liking through these types of techniques, like the law of attraction, it is only to a degree, and we also have to accept certain limitations in that. And because of that overconfidence, they can also come across a little bit uncompassionate. They might say, well, you have an illness, clearly you must have done something wrong. And that surely a person who's sick doesn't want to hear that. And it's not very compassionate and helpful to say things like that. Now, if the person on the responsibility understands that, then they might move on to the next step, which is the love stage of consciousness. And here the person really makes loving kindness, spiritual loving kindness, the centerpiece of their life. They go around and bless everybody. They send love to everybody. They spend many, many hours in meditation doing Buddhist loving kindness meditation. It doesn't have to be Buddhist, you know, any kind of loving kindness meditation. And they make that the centerpiece of their life. And the problem at this stage, there are not so many problems, but one problem that can occur is that you might at some point feel a little bit that the world is on your shoulders, that you feel a bit grief-stricken by all the suffering around you because you feel it very, very keenly. And then the person might yearn for more spiritual bliss, and then they go on to the next stage of consciousness. And that is the bliss stage of consciousness. And here people experience themselves basically a free space. So the limitations that they had before, I am this person, I had this childhood, I'm born into this culture, and I have limitation with all of this. All of that falls away radically. And the person experience, I'm just basically free space. I can be who I want to be. And basically they get in contact with what in Buddhism we call the Buddha nature, which is wisdom, love, bliss, and which we have all as our own deepest nature. And they really start to experience that on a regular basis. And all they want to do is to deepen that and to also help others to feel that as well. And now the only problem at this stage is while you are diving deep into your divine nature, all the unresolved issues from your shadow side will come to the surface. And then suddenly you get rages where you think, I never had that for decades. Where's all that rage coming from? Where's all, oh, now I remember this trauma. Oh, this is terrible. And now I remember that trauma. That must be from my past life. This can't even be from this life, you know, because I can't remember this. And so people have to work through this type of shadow work. And if they do that diligently and willingly, they basically slowly and gradually move into the last stage of consciousness, which is enlightenment. And on the enlightenment stage, the person doesn't experience themselves anymore as their identity, as they had experienced themselves before. They experience themselves as a divine being, as the divine being of their worship. So if so, for example, your own deity that you worship is Padmasambhava from Tibetan Buddhism, then you experience yourself as an embodiment of Padmasambhava. And you know, first it is an internal experience, and gradually others will see that in you as well. And if you can stabilize there, then you have basically reached the pinnacle of your development.
That's rich, thank you. And I can feel the kind of frequency of some of these stages as you describe them. I've got loads of questions. I'm imagining, you know, we've explored different developmental stage theories as well on the podcast before, and you know, you write about this in your book, but I can imagine people feel like, well, so in some places in my life, I feel, you know, I can feel like I'm at a certain stage, and in other places, I feel like I'm at another stage. People are quite rich and nuanced, and I'm just wondering how you see that maybe over time things stabilize, but that, yeah, we can, maybe there's compartmentalization or places where we're not quite integrated, or yeah, we show up differently.
Yes. So just for your listeners and viewers, I want to say that I assume that people who watch your podcast are most likely on the fourth stage of consciousness, which is ambition, or the fifth, which is sharing, and the sixth, which is responsibility. That's the most likely place where they are. Mm. And let's just say they are the responsibility stage. Yeah. So they're very self-responsible, and they're also very altruistic. So they want to work for others, not just after their egotistical status seeking. But a person like that can also sometimes get a temper tantrum, you know, and smash a cup or something. Now, if you are at the responsibility stage, if you do something like that, you will afterwards feel very guilty about that and very regretful. And you say, that was terrible. This is not like me. I'm wondering why I did this. And maybe you analyze yourself and you apologize profusely. Now, if you're a true dominance person from the which is the second stage, then you would say, well, they saw that coming, didn't they? You would actually be pleased with yourself that you did this. You would not be sorry. So that's the difference. So under stress, we can regress to lower stages. We can also, let's say, a parent dies, or, you know, you're drawn in family dynamics, and then the obedience stage will become more prevalent in you, that you feel like, in my parents, I have certain duties and I have to work according to fulfill those duties, and you get very duty bound, which is stuff from the obedience stage. So you can fall down into lower stages, but again, you come back to your predominant stage more easily. And then if you have a wonderful meditation and you experience yourself with lots of love, and also with even with bliss feelings, then you for a short moment you've gone up the stairway of consciousness, and then after your meditation you come back to your normal life, and then you say, oh, too bad, I can't stabilize myself at this high stage, and I want to have this every day, but unfortunately you don't.
Yeah, I can imagine a lot of people listening, you know, I think a lot of coaching that people do who listen to this is working at that responsibility stage, for sure. And I think there's an include, transcend and include, you know, so ambition and sharing. But I think, you know, in a lot of our programs, we've talked about this pivotal moment where you start to take full responsibility for your life and the reactions that you have, and that, you know, it's very easy to kind of subtly start blaming the world. And I catch myself doing that, you know, regularly. But I think what's changed is how quickly I can catch myself. And I think over time as well, like the healing and integration work means that there are less and less hooks, you know, less and less places where I get into that kind of make wrong mind state. And I think what's helpful about what you're sharing is I've seen this in my life and others, is where the more I've matured, sometimes it's feel like I'm going backwards, you know, because it's like, as you said, like suddenly shadow material can start to break through. And, you know, when I had my spiritual crisis, it felt like going backwards, a long way backwards, you know. It was like very disturbing. And so, yeah, maybe you could say something about that, and like, you know, around this responsibility stage, moving into love, into bliss. What's key? You know, what are the key things we need to start to do, really, and to help us stabilize or develop? Yeah,
to stabilize on the responsibility stage specifically.
Yeah, and yeah, we could talk about that, and maybe love. I know there's, you know, you were saying there's rare, fewer people, but moving into love and bliss. But I'm meeting more people who are having like deeper spiritual breakthroughs these days. So, yeah.
Yes. Yeah, so in the book, I have outlined a few meditations to stabilize ourselves at the higher stages. And so for responsibility stage, which the main practice is mindfulness, you know, to instead of lashing out or being reactive, we sit down and examine our own reactivity, and in that way we learn to be self-restrained. And we also use the law of attraction practices, where we visualize our dreams, and where we say, if I can hold my mind steadfast on my goal, it can manifest. And in my own life, I've used that a lot. I've come across it 40 years ago, and I have ever since used that to basically manifest pretty much anything in my life, or everything. And so I know from my own experience that this works brilliantly. And but on the lower stages of consciousness, you just don't trust that. You think, well, you visualize this, ha ha ha, this will never work. But when you come to the higher stages, you do get more trust, and you are more willing also to have the discipline to work with that.
Now, can I jump in and ask you about that whilst you're talking about it? Because, you know, I know we were checking in before we hit record, and one of my first Buddhist teachers was Shenpen Huckham. It's just a beloved teacher. And I think you also met Chenpen, and I think you were saying her and Rigsin Shikpo were sharing these practices on manifestation, so they have Buddhist roots to them. Could you say something about that, or maybe you came across them earlier, or
So, I mean, you probably know, and the listeners know, that there's lots and lots of books about the law of attraction, hundreds, thousands of books, you know, particularly from America, where they have that as a tradition. You know, we have that less in Europe, but in America, they have had this new thought movement, which was just roughly 100 years ago. And a famous figure of that is Napoleon Hill, Think and Grow Rich, something like that. And after that, hundreds and thousands of authors who wrote about this topic. So in our Western society, this is very well known in the New Age type of circles. But in Tibetan Buddhism, it is also known, and it's known there as it's called wish practice. And wish practice basically says the same thing like the law of attraction. If you focus on it, you can get it. But it is embedded in a lot of ethics, you know, and the ethics is, first of all, you need to wish for something that really brings you happiness. Don't waste your time on stuff that that won't do that. And then they have these stories that somebody wants money, and then a man comes to the door and gives them a check with that amount of money, but as a compensation because their son just died in the factory. And of course, that's not what you wanted, you know, and they have lots of these stories. You need to make sure that what you wish for truly is will benefit you deeply. And the answer how you can achieve that is by making your wishes in an altruistic way, so that you say, whatever I want, the house, the partner, or whatever it is, you know, that it somehow should be beneficial for the whole world. And if it is beneficial for all beings, then by logic, it must also totally and truly beneficial for you. And so there's a lot more of a deeper view on what truly brings happiness, and a lot of caution to wish for the right things and wish for them in the right way. And to do that, basically, we need to mix our own personal wishes with an altruistic heart that wants to bring happiness to other people too. So, for example, if you wish for a partner, then you say, as a couple, we want to do good for the world together, you know, like that. It's not so difficult. Or if I have a beautiful house, then you say, and a beautiful garden, then you can say, and I've opened my garden for charity so others can enjoy this too, you know. And so you can find an altruistic aspect to every of your personal wishes, unless they're truly very selfish, then you can't. But you should not wish for really selfish things. You should also, for example, not really wish for money, because, you know, money is only a means to an end. You know, you should ask yourself, what do I really want with that money? Do I want this beautiful house? Do I want these travels? Do I want whatever it is? Then wish for that directly. You know, of course, it implies that somehow you have the means to get that, or maybe somebody gives you this as a gift anyway, so you don't need the money. So there's all these kind of teachings around the basic technique of manifesting.
I remember Shenpen saying about this, like, be careful what you wish for, you know.
Yes,
and
yes,
she also
said that.
People wish for many different things all the time, conflicting things, you know, and they don't actually maintain a focus on the most important wishes that they have for themselves, which is, you know, so they're not charging that wish. And I mean, you know, what I want to ask you, because I think when I came across spirituality, and many people also with Buddhism might say, you know, manifesting things for yourself, like a house or a, you know, that isn't that kind of, that's not what Buddhism's about or spirituality is about. Could you say something about, okay, yeah, it's important for it to be altruistic, and I really appreciated the book you have on manifesting for that. I recommend people read it. And could you say, but also we are the importance of us aligning with what we wish for, you know, that we do want a partner and a house, you know, and that's not
Yes.
wrong, you know.
Yeah, that's right. So the ultimate wish in Buddhism is to reach enlightenment for the sake of all sentient beings. And you say that before every meditation, you meant to say that. And you meant to also mean it. So that's the ultimate wish, you know, to unfold your highest potential so that you can help others to do the same thing. However, apart from this ultimate wish, we also need to eat and to live somewhere, right? And if you have to work in a lousy job in a very stressful environment, and if you are sick and we haven't got a nice house, which is quite enough to do meditation, then all that becomes a bit difficult. So it is completely legitimate to wish for stuff that will enable you to live the life in which you then can meditate and pursue the path of towards enlightenment. So and that's in part for it's also human companionship. So to want a partner, to want a family, you know, to help the children to grow up and help them. That's the bodhisattva path. So all the things, the ordinary things that we normally need in life, a home, a partner, family, good work, work that is appreciated by others, meaning well paid, but the point is it's appreciated so that you're not just doing good stuff and everybody treats you like as if this is worthless. And so then you work yourself into the ground because you're not getting enough money for it so that you can live off it. All of that is completely compatible with the ultimate wish for enlightenment for the sake of all sentient beings.
That's really helpful. Where do you see people going wrong with these wishes? Like, do you think there's like a common way that people do it where it doesn't work so well?
Yes. So on the ambition stage, and the main wrong wish that people have is status. They believe, and also on the lower stages, they believe in some sort of pecking order, and somehow you need to be up and be superior, and you need to avoid being down, whatever it means for you, you know. And you believe if I have this success and I'm up and I get the PhD title and I look amazing and in some way I'm better and have higher status than others, that will bring me happiness. And that's actually the way I understand this. These type of wishes come from our animal nature, you know, because animals, mammals live in pecking orders. And they need to be up and need to avoid to be down on these pecking orders. And so as human beings, we still do that. You know, if we meet somebody, we compare ourselves. Am I up? Are you down? Then it's good. Oh no, it's the other way around. That's bad. And now I feel bad about myself and trick my inferiority complex. You know, that's normal feelings. Everybody has that. But this is also where we go most wrong, you know. Because happiness and enlightenment doesn't come from status. Happiness and enlightenment comes from love, from loving relationships in your family life and also in your work life. You know, I mean, obviously you don't love your work colleagues or your clients like you love your partner, but you still, what you do needs to be done with this kind of loving wish to benefit this person. And if you have that, you know, and you will find true fulfillment, and no status can ever give you this.
That's super helpful. Maybe we could go back to, you know, you were talking about the practices that help people stabilize at later stages. I'm thinking, you know, maybe moving from that responsibility to love stage. I know a practice I've had is like blessing people, you know, I
Yes.
was given just like see the highest potential in people and bless people. What kind of practice, other practices would you
Yeah, so for the
advise?
responsibility level, we have manifesting, mindfulness and also the gratefulness exercise, to be profoundly grateful for everything that you have and basically genuinely be able to let go of the complaining and the blaming and the, you know, the whinging and all of that, because you are truly grateful. And then on the love stage of consciousness is basically meditating on loving kindness. And in Buddhism, we have beautiful meditations for that. You send love to yourself. You send love to your enemies. You send love to the neutral person. So the person that you feel nothing about, the shop assistant or the taxi driver. And then you send love to your village, to your country, to the whole world. And you just do that for hours and hours and hours, either in retreat or every day. And it will establish you on your on the love stage of consciousness. And I have, once done a retreat like this on loving kindness, and it had a profound impact on me. It was really, really beautiful. And the bliss stage of consciousness, there are various methods really there, but, you know, there isn't really a true method to come to the bliss stage. The bliss is more a fruition of what you've done before. If you've done, you know, if you do gratefulness, you manifest your dreams, you have sent lots of love, naturally you will become happy. And if you then focus on that feeling itself, it will spread, and you get into more and more profound states of spiritual bliss. And so it's not something that you can actually reach with the technique. It's more a fruition that comes by itself. And then from the bliss stage of consciousness, if you do that long enough, you at some point spontaneously arise as the deity. You will find yourself to be the deity of your worship again. There might, in Tibetan Buddhism, they do what is called deity yoga, where you visualize yourself as the deity to help this process along. The danger with that practice is that it can really foster megalomania, that people who have grandiose tendencies say, yes, yes, I am Guru Rinpoche, I am White Tara, you need to worship me now. And that is, of course, a big trap, you know, so we have to avoid that. So I teach more the path where you... where this happens more spontaneously.
This reminds me of something I read in your book about where you said, like, one of the most efficacious practices, the best practices, is to kind of resonate or connect to somebody who embodies the quality that you'd like to embody yourself. Could you say something about that practice?
Yes. So this would be a devotional practice. And contrary to what most people believe about Buddhism, the devotional practices are actually seen as the fastest way to enlightenment. And, a lot of people think, yeah, Buddhism doesn't know any deities and they just do all the work themselves. They just meditate on their meditation cushion. But that's only part of Buddhism. And Tibetan Buddhism, we very much have also the devotional path, and it's seen as the superior path. The only problem is that many of us are not devotional by nature, particularly if you have a lot of education and any devotional tendency in you has been shredded in the rational analysis of reality, then it's a little bit hard to get back to that, you know. For those of us who are not very devotional, we need to do more work on the meditation cushion. But if you have any kind of tendency towards that, you know, you should try to focus on this and develop this and really try to have a personal relationship with your own higher power, or whatever name you call them, that's completely fine. And spend time in prayer and in communion with them. And the more you can do that, that will be the fastest path.
So would you advocate then people, how would you advocate people to develop a devotional relationship with a higher self, or, a guide, or, like, is it just start praying and contacting, speaking to them, or?
That would be one way. In my personal practice, the way I work with my clients, I don't say pray to your higher consciousness because, as I said, most people don't have this devotional tendency or talent anymore, you know. So what I'm saying to them is imagine your deity or your higher power as a small figure, as a light figure in your heart, in your chest. And imagine that light radiates out into your body and all around you as if giving you a hug. That's my standard practice that I teach. And this is also a Tibetan Buddhist practice. What I've done in my work, I have summarized and simplified some Tibetan Buddhist practices to make them more accessible to the general public. So taking out a lot of the ritual, the jargon, but the essence I have very much preserved and teach that in that way to help people also who are not having the karma to be a Tibetan Buddhist, because Tibetan Buddhism can be a bit strange.
I'd love to share my experience a little bit here, because I think it could be a nice springboard to talk about, to ask some questions. And I kind of alluded to it before, and I'm not making any claims about my stage of consciousness, but I think some of the things you've shared really reflect a journey I've been on. And because I think it might move us into a conversation about spiritual crisis and what to do in those moments, because I think I see more people going through this too. I've shared this story on the podcast before, but I was doing Tibetan tantric practice and energy work, and I was a father of a new baby, and then the pandemic hit, and just everything, I could feel myself starting to cut, you know. And one morning I went out for a walk and I felt something like rip at the top of my head, and then this kind of actually terror descended. And I went back to my wife and I was like, what the hell just happened? And I, from there, like over the next weeks, I went through a process of, dissolving, you know, like everything deconstructed and dissolved. And there was a lot of energy in my body, moments when everything dissolved into a void. And, you know, through contact with spiritual teachers and embodied support, I moved through that. But what I'm sharing is because then I started to experience these like states of well-being that were profound. And, I would just be sat on the couch, you know, and it, you know, if I'm honest, it was a little bit when I used to take ecstasy when I was a, you know, I'd like just have this love, this bliss in my heart or in my belly. And I'd just be, and, you know, it kind of integrated, but now I've noticed in my journey, it vacillates in and out, some more often in these days. And devotion has become really important to me. So this just gets to another question. I'm just layering a few things in, and I'll see where you take it. When I was more exclusively Buddhist, what I liked about Buddhism was it was like your means of your own liberation is in your own hands. But I got to a point where I was like, oh, there's this. I just started praying, you know. Prayer became. And I was like, I just don't want to do it all myself, you know? And I started praying for support and for grace, and the sweetness that came through was just profound. So I wonder for you if you see that being, you know, what's my question here? I'm not asking about where I'm at, but it's more like, are there commonalities that you see from people who go through spiritual crises? And what's supportive to those people in those moments?
Yes, I do see very much the commonality. So this is the main work that I'm doing. And so commonly, this kind of spiritual crisis is known as Kundalini awakening. You know, I don't personally like that word so much because some people are afraid of the Kundalini and think it's a snake lying in your abdomen somewhere. And I've come up with the Kundalini test. Everybody can do that. You can just go to my website, put your name in there, and you get the Kundalini test. But I'm also going to say it here now. So there's just five criteria. So the first one is when you have a Kundalini awakening or a spiritual awakening, first of all, your interest in spirituality becomes much more intense. It becomes the absolute center point of your life. It might have been already before the awakening, but it becomes even more intense afterwards. And then you're, so I'm sure you would nod your head. That's correct. Yeah, that you experienced that as well. And then your emotions get intensified. You know, you're not just getting fear, you get terror. You're not just having a bit depressed. No, you have terrible existential despair and so on. You know, lots of intense emotions. And with that goes also a much intensified sensitivity. You go into a room, you say, the vibration is so bad, I have to go out immediately. This is terrible, I can't stand this. Or I could feel this other person's thoughts and feelings. I'm not sure it was them, but I'm pretty sure. And now you go into a church and you say, oh, the vibration is so beautiful. I was in a bliss state, you know, so this extreme sensitivity. And then you also have energy movement in your body, which you also said, something ripped off from your skull. And then a terror descended, so you felt this tangibly as a kind of energy. And people have that done a lot. So what before the Kundalini awakening is maybe a lump of dead meat, apart from maybe sexual arousal, suddenly becomes a whirling, a wafting place of energy going up and down and damming up in certain places and making blocks and then dissolving into sweetness and streams of nectars flowing through your being so you can have these experiences. And then for a lot of people, they also get paranormal experience. You know, they get more clairvoyant, they might see beings and they have the divine beings become more real. So they bhakti, the devotion becomes much easier because you don't experience your higher power as whatever, a statue or a picture from somebody who lived a few thousand years ago. You know, they become a living presence to you. And so that makes devotion much easier. And these are the five criteria, really. And when they all come together, then I would classify that as a Kundalini awakening or spiritual awakening.
What can people do to help move through that process? I know that's, like you said, that's the core of the work you do. Are there specific things that people can do? I mean, you know, obviously reaching out to you, doing work with you, but...
If you allow me, I use you as an example. So if you'd come to me with your crisis, terror descending into your body, so then I would have said, on a scale from 0 to 10, how much anxiety or terror do you feel? And you might have said 9, okay? And 9 out of 10, and so very bad. And then I would have said, then I would have taught you the anti-anxiety technique, which has 4 stages, and which is described in all of my books for anybody who wants to find out how that works. And then you would, then I would practice this with you for 5 minutes. And after the 5 minutes, you would be from 9, mostly, let's say, down to 6 or 5. And then we would practice another 5 minutes together, and then you would be at 2.5. So because it's working very, very fast, then I would say to you, that's great, you can do it. Now you practice this every day. Don't expect you get the results quite as fast as we do it together, but you can do that. And then within weeks, you would be from 9 down to at least 5, but probably lower. Within months, you would be a 3 or 2, depending on how diligently you practice. And then you can have all the deconstructions of reality. You would find that amusing. You would find that interesting. If the anxiety is out of the question, you can look at all of the, out of the picture. Then you can look at all these spiritual deconstruction or whatever happens, you know, with curiosity, with amusement, and you would go home to your wife and would say, "You don't believe what I experienced today." I see the nature of reality now. It's not what it seems. And but it's all, not terrifying anymore. So you just take the negative emotions out, everything else becomes easy.
Yeah, that really resonates, because I've had that where you have certain phenomena, and if the anxiety is there, it's like, ugh. But if you're feeling the well-being and the bliss, it doesn't, it's completely different. So that's really helpful. What would you say is the it's probably very unique to every person, but the do you think deepening into awakening is about, you know, disconnecting from life and living in a, you know, monastery? Or is it like becoming more and more functional in the world, more and more loving and connected and intimate and human? You know, this has been an inquiry I've had with friends, you know, and people rejecting these days more, it seems like a kind of transcendent view of reality, which labels earthly things as, you know, as in the way of our fulfillment and awakening.
Yes. So Tibetan Buddhism gives us a very clear answer to that. The householder life is superior for reaching enlightenment.
Yeah.
That's a good answer, right?
Yeah, that's great.
I'm glad you like it. So that doesn't mean if you're a monk or nun that that's wrong or that you're disadvantaged, but let's just say in the Buddhist context, if you're a nun or monk, you know, everybody gives you reverence, everybody folds their hand in namaste and bows to you, and so you're not getting challenged. But if you live at home with your partner and your children, your ego and your reactivity gets challenged every day, and your partner, your wife, becomes your guru. Basically, she tells you, now today you're very grumpy again. Yeah, that was very selfish of you. And then your ego goes, oh, how dare she criticize me? No, wait a minute. I need to be patient here and compassionate. And so you have so ample space for practicing all of this. Because quite honest, to get bliss in the meditation, this isn't even that difficult, you know. If, you know, this can be taught actually quite quickly to people. To maintain compassionate view in the face of provocation, that's harder. And for that, we need the householder life. We don't, and there we can learn this much better, particularly with children. I mean, this is fantastic bodhisattva training, you know. Children are made to drive us to distraction, because then we will give them a boundary and they need the boundary, you know, and therefore they will test the boundary every day of their life, at least most children do. And so and to do that, to fulfill this parenting role in a compassionate but not laissez-faire way, you know, just do what you want, but really educate and bring up the child properly with boundaries, you know, this is quite a task, and in fantastic bodhisattva training, I think.
I completely agree. It's like really, it's the ultimate training, because just as you think you've got it, you know, then they change or it's different.
That's right.
So it's like you can never rest. And therefore, how do you see the times we find ourselves in, you know, where it seems, you know, it feels like we're in the level of uncertainty feels so palpable. Maybe we're waking up to how things were always so uncertain, but we just didn't see it. But anyway, certainly right now, you know, do you feel like these are even, because I've noticed that in me, it's like I've had to meet parts of myself. And so it feels like a gift, you know, these times. And I'm privileged. I'm not living in a war zone or something, so, you know, it's easy for me to say that. But how do you see these times?
Well, I am a determined optimist. And I think we never had it better than now. I think these are the best times ever.
Can you say why? Yeah.
Because, I'm 65 now. So from when I was young, children were still, you know, different races, disabled children, gay people, all the lot were terribly discriminated against. When you look how much loving kindness there is, particularly, let's say I live in the UK, I think the UK is a particularly compassionate country, you know, compared to my home country, which is Germany or other countries that I know well. You know, so much compassion, so much help for everybody, so much effort being made to not discriminate against minorities. I think this is quite wonderful. And also through the internet, now so many people getting access to these spiritual teachings that I would have never touched with a barge pole before. But now you scroll through your YouTube or whatever, and then you come across about this and that, and you know, deep breathing or what to do about toxic parents. And you think, oh, I click on that one. My parents were quite toxic. And then somehow it just, you know, it educates you. It educates you in a spiritual and psychological way. So people develop in an unprecedented speed. I can see that, you know, the last 20 years in my counseling practice, a very important aspect is self-love. People need to kind of be compassionate with yourself. I need to teach this a lot less, you know, 30 years ago, you know, self-love, that was blasphemy. That was embarrassing. You just didn't do that, you know, and people suffered so much. But now most people know self-love is a good thing. You shouldn't be so hard on yourself. And so I can see humankind developing, and I also see that people getting nicer and friendlier every year, you know. And maybe not everybody will agree with me, and maybe this is just my personal experience, but I certainly see that, you know, times are getting better and better. That doesn't matter. That doesn't mean there isn't a war in various places in the world, but there always have been wars, you know, and there always have been developments where people try to turn back the clock. And as we can see in America now, you know, very conservative movement, you know, yes, there's always a discussion in that, but this is we are going forward in a positive way. That is what I perceive.
Do you know, you may not feel like this is the right way to frame it, but, and I don't know if it's either, but I see some teachers talking about how we're in the midst of, you know, that there's a coming kind of breakthrough in consciousness coming, you know, where we will, yeah, you know, love will break through, not a love which is opposed to fear, but which can include fear. Yeah, do you see something like that happening?
Yes, I do. You know, as I've just described, you know, through the internet, people who would have never gone to a workshop on shadow work, let's say, and then they go and do this shadow work on YouTube, and students for 21 years, you know, and then I think, what are you doing shadow work for? You know, oh yeah, it was on YouTube. And then they open themselves up to these dimensions. So I have seen this acceleration of spiritual wisdom and psychological development definitely since the internet is there. And that, you know, we forget the internet has only been there for roughly 25 years. Before, we were in the dark ages, you know. And I remember those days very well. I was 40 when the internet came, you know, before. We were lonely because there was no forum in which you could go and chat with other people. There was no Facebook and giving comments and connecting with other people. And, you know, you were sitting at home. You might get a phone call or you read a book. And that was that, you know. Mm-hmm. You could watch a bit of telly. But you didn't have all this way of connecting to others like we have now. This is just so much change. It's so absolutely wonderful.
Yeah, that's beautiful. Yeah, I really appreciate you sharing that. And I find it amazing too. Like not only the creativity, you know, of what happens when all these different communities start connecting, and you know, new ideas and projects emerge out of that. And you know, I know I came across your work through The Leading Edge, you know, and you know, that's an example of a community that's come together around spiritual awakening and purpose. And I see more of those kinds of things popping up. So we're getting close to our time, Tara, and I just wonder if there's anything you would like to share, you know, to our listeners. You know, maybe you've shared so much already, but is there anything that comes up for you that feels important to share as we move to a closing?
Yes. So basically, just by reading the book, Stairway to Heaven, this is what it's called, you can determine quite easily on what stage of consciousness you are. And you will also from that know very easily, without a lot of pressure and a lot of effort, know what's the next step is in your life. It will basically evolve in you just from reading the book. So I had that feedback many times. That it helps you to have a compassionate understanding of yourself, a compassionate understanding about the world. And maybe you can even join me in my optimistic view of the world development. I know not many people do, but it's definitely a better place to be rather than perceiving doom and gloom around you the whole time. And that's not just because I'm a fluffy person and just want to see everything positive. The framework from which I say that is because I can see that our societies as a whole are moving up the stairway of heaven, you know, and you know, there's you can see the signs and symptoms of that. So there is real evidence for that. It's not just a nice feeling that I have. And if you want to experience that too, just read the book. And I hopefully this will evoke in you effortlessly a more compassionate, liberating, and optimistic view of yourself and the world.
Beautiful. And I recommend people go to your website as well. There's a lot of resources there. What's your website address?
TaraSpringert.com.
Great. Tara, thanks so much. I'm really happy to share this with our community.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Okay, thanks for tuning into the podcast. I hope you enjoyed it. And a reminder, the early bird enrollment for our upcoming live online training program, The Power of Embodied Transformation, is open, and it's going to teach you how to tap into the transformational arena that is the embodied life of your client. It's a necessity in our times, so you can create lasting change with your clients. So just head to coachesrising.com/power of embodied transformation to book your spot, and the early bird discount is open until February the 20th. Here we are, we're at the end of the podcast. Just a heads up again, if you're not on our mailing list and you want to stay in the loop about other things we create, then head to coachesrising.com, put your name in the sign up box there. You'll also find some of our other offerings, our online trainings for coaches there. And just want to end by wishing you well, and I'll see you again next time.